Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's Cast Cerberus podcast with a K. My name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Cast Cerberus, which you probably know, and if you don't, then you should by now. You should be visiting regularly www.casterberus.com, where you'll find articles by myself and none by my two colleagues, Brian Turnover and James McLean.
Hello.
Hi.
With a K.
With a K.
So this week's Cast Cerberus podcast, we're just going to cover a couple of news items and have a bit of a chat, you know, general chinwag, chew the fat over what's been going on in the Doctor Who world over the last few days, which on the face of it isn't very much, other than a few public appearances. Most notably, I think, and no disrespect to the Grand Moff, or as he's apparently called, the Moffinator, which is a frankly ridiculous name.
Ooh, that's terrible.
They're both terrible.
Well, I think you'll find I coined the Grand Moff, James, so...
It's terrible.
Steady up. Matt Smith carrying the Olympic torch on Saturday morning, which, for those of you who are into this kind of Olympic torch-bearing thing, is quite good, and obviously for Doctor Who fans, it's quite good in that respect. Turning up at 7 o'clock in the morning to run a few yards around Cardiff Bay. Did you guys see this?
I haven't. No. I know of it, but I didn't watch it.
It'll be on Cast Cerberus by the time this podcast's out. It'll be on Cast Cerberus by the time this podcast's recorded, possibly even by the time I finish this sentence.
In fact, I hadn't even been aware that he'd actually done it, despite the fact knowing that there was Olympic-y things going on this weekend. So good on him.
Yeah. Now, from what I can tell, he basically he turned up there, and then they keep the flame in a little lamp. I'm a little bit dubious about this whole nature of flames lasting. Surely it's not the same flame if it's been lit onto several devices for carrying the flame. Surely it's a new flame by then. I don't know. I don't know if you know, it's just a little bit of trivia. Olympic flame was introduced by the Nazis for the 1936
really?
Olympics. Yeah. So basically, ever since then, a Nazi piece of a Nazi custom has been reproduced every 4 years. That's makes you think a bit. But of course, a lot of Doctor Who fans wanted David Tennant to carry the torch.
Yes, indeed, we
for
did.
Obvious reasons, possibly to make Fear Her more watchable. I don't know. What do you think?
But it wasn't in Cardiff where he was carrying the torch, so it wouldn't carry any.
Well, no, that's right.
City anyway, so.
No.
Do you think he still could carry the torch?
I still think he could. There's still plenty of. They're not done with it, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, they've got to go to Northern Ireland, Scotland, the northeast, my neck of the woods. In fact, they're going to pass. My house about, what is it, about half a mile away from my house. Unfortunately, they're doing it at 7 a.m. one morning. So we probably won't, just, you know, with the logistics of having babies and getting them all sorted up and then going to watch someone run past and then turning back again. Probably isn't something that we're going to do. But it's the Olympics. It seems to be invading our lives. Now, you've had Olympics in the USA quite a lot, Brian.
Yeah.
That I can think of. Did it tend to invade your lives beforehand? Because you can't turn on the television at the moment without seeing the Olympics. And the Olympics haven't even started yet.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Like, it invaded my life in that respect. In the fact that, you know, when I tried to watch something I wanted to turn the TV on to watch, I couldn't because it was preempted for the Olympics.
Mm.
You know, so it was all over the place, you know, like that was all that was on TV whenever the Olympics were here or just whenever the Olympics are, like even with you guys having them, they're going to be on our TV soon enough. It's the only thing it's going to be on. I don't watch TV anymore, to be honest. Live TV, I usually catch things after the fact.
Yeah.
So I really don't, it's probably all over the TV right now. I do know there was a snippet on the Olympics on the news yesterday. I was, my dad was watching some and I had caught some of it there. So it's already started, but yeah. It's very in your face here, yeah. No matter who has it.
Well, what do you think, Jane? Oh, sorry, go on, Brian.
No, I was just gonna say about David Tennant though, like, and Matt Smith, like, I think it's cool for Matt Smith. I think it's very neat because I'm sure it's a huge honor. I'm not a big Olympics fan myself. I don't actually watch them much like any other sporting event. I'm not really that keen on watching them. But if it were David Tennant, for the story reasons and for that little just like fun little reality or rather fiction becoming reality thing, I would have watched for that. But you know, as much as I'm happy for Matt Smith, I couldn't watch it. It just wasn't interesting enough for me.
Yeah.
I think it is. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, I'm watching a clip now on a website called Casterbras.com.
Oh, it sounds good.
/2012/05/the-wrong-hyphen.
Never heard of it.
/the-wrong-doctor/. Or you could go to YouTube, actually, and just forget Casterbras.com. Go and see it there.
On this occasion.
Could be easier. I was watching it, and it's not even the Doctor, obviously. It's Matt Smith. It's a celebrity representing one of Cardiff's biggest products at the moment, famous products at the moment, and that's what he's doing there. It's not really about the Doctor or Fear Her or any real link there at all.
But I would like to think that certainly my point of view, from my perspective, and I think probably from yours as well, but perhaps not wider fandom, that we're like quite aware that there's other stuff going on in the world. Do you think that this whole build-up of the Olympics is similarly getting wrapped up in itself, but forgetting that there's all this other stuff going on in the world, and because it's a bigger thing than Doctor Who, that it takes itself far too seriously?
So you're saying, is the Olympics like Doctor Who have a tendency for the supporters of it to give it too much credence than it deserves, which you could argue, as you say, might be happy with Doctor Who fans being a little myth that David Tennant isn't involved in.
Indeed,
Yeah, probably. I mean, I suppose it is a big historical event, but, you know, everything is a historical event, really, when it comes down to it.
Well, absolutely. And,
I know it's something for people to be excited about. I know it's a reason for our country, hopefully, to have some pride in, pending any horrible disasters or, you know, financial or otherwise. But it is. I do worry because, I mean, obviously here we've got a lot of political issues at the moment on various levels, and to me, somehow in my brain, it's overly prioritized. And I don't think, if it wasn't on the front cover, if it wasn't on every news item, if it wasn't being discussed everywhere, it wouldn't lessen its importance. I think that's what buggers me. And the same with Doctor Who, really. I mean, I'm a very private Doctor Who person. I don't tend to talk about it, particularly outside you people and a couple of others and my family. I'm not interested in you know, standard bearing and whatever some people are, and I kind of wish that these sort of things were a little more in proportion.
Okay, this is obviously clearly turning into a terribly British podcast.
It is a bit, isn't it? I'm trying my best to keep it on Doctor Who.
So we'll move on. Now I was watching the BAFTAs last evening, Sunday evening, in which one show, which was expected to do really well, didn't do that well at all, really. And other shows did, which is usually the way these award ceremonies go. Now, while I was watching it, I had my HP touchpad by my side, running Android on it, which is one for all you techies out there. And I had Twitter loaded up, so I was keeping an eye on things, you know, as you do. I think it's a bit of a common phenomenon now, isn't it? People sort of with a laptop or a tablet in front of the telly having a kind of social viewing experience. It isn't something I've done that much, to be honest with you. It's only something I've kind of started doing in the last week, which for my kind of what I do when I'm not doing Casterbras is a bit... I don't know, people raised their eyebrows at me last time I mentioned this on Saturday. So anyway, so I was on Twitter whilst I was watching the BAFTAs, and there were quite a few people were having a rip at Stephen the Grand Moff Moffat, as we call him here.
Or as we call him, Stephen Moffat.
Indeed.
That's me and Brian.
Yeah, that's you and Brian. Yeah.
The normal people.
Feeling that he went on a bit too long and perhaps was a little bit... what's the best word? Well, people said smug, but I'm not sure smug's a very good word. I think that's a very cheap word to use, but perhaps What's a good alternative phrase?
You don't need an alternative. You're talking about what people said, so that's what they said. Yeah. So we're going to talk about it.
Did you find it indulgent? Is that a better word?
I think perhaps it was indulgent, but then given that he's
self-celebratory,
Dennis Potter Award, I think perhaps being indulgent is okay. I'm not sure it was that word.
Yeah, you know what I mean. I didn't even say it right, so carry on.
Satisfying. But, you know, there were people saying, ooh, what are you doing? And then there was people commenting on other things. What do you guys think? It's an awards ceremony. You're going to get this, aren't you? It's better to have a rehearsed acceptance speech, because Stephen Moffat knew that he was getting this beforehand, because it had been in the papers. Whereas there were people saying that they were getting up like Jennifer Saunders or Andrew Scott from Sherlock, who did claim that they didn't know that they were getting them and were a little bit flustered. I've never been to an award ceremony, so my experience of these things is limited to what I've seen on telly, and I don't watch them that often.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't normally watch award shows myself. So I didn't see this one, and I know we had maybe talked a little bit about it, but I still am not even sure what he did that makes people think he was smug. However, I know that some things that he says can come off that way, but he's also a lot of times got a joking manner about it. Like he's, you know, when he talks about how handsome he is or something like that, or if he says something like that, he knows, you know, you can tell rather his tone, he's joking with it.
Yeah.
You know, so what did he do? Like what actually happened?
He got excited by the fact that he had his award given to him by Matt Smith and Benedict Cumberbatch, describing them as Sherlock Holmes and Doctor Who, which I thought was possibly a little bit silly, because he presumably knew that they were going to be giving him the award.
Do you think there's a confusion amongst the show and maybe even those who are involved in it between the balance between it being an awards ceremony for the industry and the fact that it's showcased as a show for spectators? And so you have this very awkward imbalance, because if it's an industry show, like you'd have any industry ceremony, you're going to get a lot of thanks, you're going to get a little pomposity, because it's, you're awarding yourself. You're saying this is a great industry, this is the peak of our industry, we're being proud of it. But as spectators watching it, you know, you don't really care about the names being rattled off, and it can look indulgent and it can probably look smug. And I'll be honest, I do think he can be a bit of an arse at times, overly so, publicly, that is. I don't know what he's like in his private life. Comes across that way anyway. But I don't think, I think the problem is that if you're not really into what the BAFTAs is about, and as I say, it's about the industry awarding itself and feeling good about itself and feeling positive, then don't watch it, like me.
Well, there's a funny thing about the BAFTAs, isn't there? And the BAFTAs and the Oscars, when you compare them to the various video game awards, if we consider that the video awards, the video games industry is huge, and you know it rivals Hollywood. Has it overtaken Hollywood?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, and you know how many people spend their time. I mean, video games awards aren't broadcast on television, are they? I think they've been featured in, you know, like smaller programs and like small 5-minute segments, things. But they're not given, you know, like 3-hour time slots on a Sunday evening on primetime television.
Well, maybe that is part of the problem. The part of the problem is that the entertainment awards have sort of been caught within its own whirlwind of almost aristocracy, its celebratory status, that they're sort of half aware that they are very important to people's lives, while the people behind video games are not. Or in any other award situation. So because there's no doubt that the people involved in the entertainment industry, there is a lot of ego there. There is a lot of awareness that it's being televised, that it is very important to people's lives.
Yeah.
And who's behind these shows is very important to people's lives. People discuss the creator of the current producer of Doctor Who, but they're unlikely to be discussing the head honcho's Rockstar, or, you know, it's not got that sort of power. So it probably is a very, like a spoilt child industry. The spoilt child isn't really a bad person, but has that sort of slightly self-absorbed attitude. So you get shows like this, which are too long, they are far too pompous because the industry rates does see itself as being so very important. Mm-hmm. And the other factor is it is very important because the individuals watching, the viewers, give it that importance. So it sort of becomes this horrible sort of slightly spoiled child thing, this crying attention-seeking baby. And I guess everyone involved in it has a bit of that. We probably all do if we were given that opportunity. So it's Moffat's moment. I don't have any issues. I say, you know, if you don't like hearing him, then just turn it off. But you know, he has done a lot, whether you like his shows or not. He has done a lot for television of late, the last few years. Yeah, whether you like Doctor Who or not, it's still a worldwide relevant program, even more so in America now than ever. Whether that's to do with Moffat or the way the show's been run or the gradual build-up, I don't know, but he's a linchpin in that. He's a figurehead. Same with Sherlock, massively popular show. His other shows he's done have always been very good on the sci-fi front, have always been respected. Yeah, he should have his moment of glory, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just going to say there's something to be said too for like we were talking about how these award ceremonies, you know, like some of them seem like they acted like they didn't know they had won, while other people had clearly known that they had won. And generally in these award ceremonies, they kind of try to alert the person who did win so that they can have them there on hand, you know. So some people, when they already know and they know it's coming and they know to get up there, they either have a speech prepared or, you know, they rehearse these things as well sometimes, these award ceremonies. Yeah. You know, and you know, I know that some people don't like the fact that the spontaneity is gone, and you know, they could just be, you know, they can come across improper because they're not speaking genuinely for the first time. They're saying something that they've said a couple times now and just trying to get the words out at this point.
I think some of them, I think as Christian said, I think in this case, I think some of them were spontaneous. I tuned in on iPlayer because I thought Andrew Scott was absolutely fantastic as Moriarty in Sherlock. So I tuned in to see his acceptance speech, and he genuinely did look flustered, and he was rattling off names in a way as if he wasn't prepared. I didn't get the impression he was ready. I could be wrong. He is an actor.
He's an actor, indeed. Yeah.
So he could have been. But
when I was watching, I noticed that the category that John Sim was nominated in for Exile,
yeah,
which was obviously with the same as Benedict Cumberbatch for Sherlock and Dominic West for
The Firm.
The one that he won.
I can't remember. It's good, yeah.
Yeah. And just another thing, if John Sim was nominated in that category for that that drama, then why wasn't Jim Broadbent? But anyway, I did notice that John Sim seemed very pissed off that he didn't win.
Really?
Yeah. Like he, I don't think he normally goes to award ceremonies, John Sim, does he? I don't recall ever seeing him.
He doesn't seem the type.
No, exactly. He doesn't seem the type. But I don't ever recall seeing him on one of these things before. So maybe he went because he'd been told he was likely to win and then found that he hadn't. And on Twitter afterwards, he said, "Home at last." And then hash never again.
I must admit, I was disappointed with Benedict's win on that. Because while I think he has obviously done a lot for that show and he's a good actor, you know, almost like having the Doctor up for a part. When you're playing larger than life characters like that, to me, in my head, and some people could say this is wrong, it is an easier role than having to play straighter, more realistic characters, because you've got so much more freedom to escape into, where you're not having to, you know, there's nothing hard. I mean, they always say that the villain is a far easier role to play than the hero, because the villain's got so much more layers to it than the hero tends to have. So if you can do a good hero, you're onto something which is a far harder concept. I do feel that a bit with Sherlock, and John Sims probably, I could possibly see from an actor's point of view, a little frustration. I could imagine him wanting to win an award for one of his less over-the-top roles, like The Master, than The Master, because The Master is just, there's no subtlety there. And the same with Sherlock. There are moments of subtlety, but there aren't that many moments. It's more about shouting and firing and stealing the show, is, and that's what the character's there to do. So I can sort of imagine why you might feel a bit peeved if Benedict gets it.
It's okay, because Benedict didn't get it.
Oh, didn't he?
Did. Dominic West got it.
Oh, Dominic got it. Oh, well, yeah. He was actually quite good in that. I'm actually quite pleased. I'm sure I read someone. I must have, again, this is a problem reading Twitter. I'm sure someone said that Benedict had got it, and I was thinking,
no, I didn't know. Sherlock got was Andrew Scott.
But you see, that's where I'm a bit of a hypocrite, because in a way I kind of think, yeah, I'm glad he got that, even though he's doing exactly the thing, which I'm saying isn't that hard. But somehow he did it really, really well, to a point which seemed to make Benedict's role look really pale and boring.
Yeah, he was also good as Paul McCartney, I thought, in the Lennon Naked.
I've not seen that.
I never knew that was him.
Yes, yeah, same guy.
I think you had mentioned that the other day, and I was shocked about that.
Yeah, same guy, yeah.
But no, yeah, I mean, he was good. Maybe because he was a supporting role, you know, he wasn't the obvious Doctor Who, like, in, you know, lead character. He came in knowing that he had to face off a very strong actor, Benedict playing a very strong part and doing it very, very well, not knocking that. And yet he came along and as a fairly unknown actor, really just blasted everyone away with his performance in the last series. And I'm kind of pleased in a weird hypocritical way that he got that. But yeah, it's nice when you see characters which aren't playing such outlandish roles get the awards, because that is a hard thing, I imagine.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we'll move on to this week's final item, which is, and I was particularly excited about this. I don't know about you guys. Have either of you ever read any Stephen Baxter?
No, I haven't.
James? No? Okay. Stephen Baxter is... It was confirmed a few... Well, it was confirmed this week. It was been rumored for a little while. It was confirmed this week that Stephen Baxter, sci-fi writer extraordinaire, is contributing to the Doctor Who range from the BBC books. We're back to the big format books again, such as the recent Gareth Roberts adaptation of Sharda. Stephen Baxter is writing a book called The Wheel of Ice, which features the Second Doctor, Jamie and Zoe. Stephen Baxter's been winning awards for science fiction for years. He'd been around before this. I first discovered him around 15 years ago when he wrote a official sequel to The Time Machine called The Time Ships, which takes The Time Machine and spins it off into infinity. It's a very, very astounding book. Certainly changed the way I look at time travel. Before that, but from being someone who was a fan of time travel related stories as a young chap. So this is pretty big news in sci-fi circles. Hopefully, in comparison to a previous piece of big news in sci-fi circles, which was obviously Michael Moorcock's Doctor Who book, it will be a little more easy to read. Guys, what do you think? Getting all these big names in to write Doctor Who books, is it a good thing?
I don't see it as a bad thing. I mean, clearly getting good writers to tell good stories is always going to be a good thing. It's just whether or not they're telling good stories. I'm pleased to see that he's writing for a second Doctor. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's what they're planning to do with these large format books, is to look at past Doctors, yeah. But, James, is it not the case that there are plenty of existing writers within the Doctor Who pantheon who are very good, who perhaps haven't had their chance over the last 5 or 10 years?
Well, it's always the risk, isn't it? And it's the same with pretty much every industry in the entertainment, is that it gets dominated by the big names, because the big names sell, ship more products, which is always kind of a sad thing. Be you an actor, be you a producer, be you a television company, be you an author. And it's a sucky situation. It's financial certainty versus finding new talent. So, yeah, I mean, apparently, as I recall, in February 2007, he was announced as the author of a Big Finish Doctor Who audio series. If my memory is correct from reading this Wikipedia article 30 seconds ago. So he's been lined up for Doctor Who for a while, by the sounds of it, in some form or another. And that was put on hold indefinitely. I didn't know about that.
Interesting.
But, yeah, no, I see what you mean. I mean, I suppose you could argue that there isn't... Maybe the Doctor Who series has been fairly good, though. I mean, there's a lot of names still being used who are veterans to the Doctor Who novelization range.
Are they veterans, though, or are they fittings and fixtures?
Well, you could argue that, couldn't you? But again, it's what ships, isn't it? It's what, I suppose, you know, you've got quantifiable things, you know, who are going to deliver reasonable or stories
Well, I mean,
to your...
this is perfectly a personal opinion, okay? And this by no means is fact. It's basically, it's purely my opinion. I don't believe Jacqueline Rayner has written anything that I would want to read since the one with the wolves. The title of which I can't quite recall, but it goes back sort of 8 years or so.
That good.
8 or 9 years, probably. What year are we in now? Yeah, about 8 or 9 years. Similarly, Justin Richards, I've tried reading his books since. The Clockwise Man was okay back in 2005, but he's never written anything that touches on System Shock, which he is a man who is from the IT industry, and System Shock is about an IT-based invasion of Earth. It's got stuff in it which really should have been in Age of Steel. Rise of the Cybermen. It's that kind of high-tech look aspect of taking over the world. And it even uses technology, even refers to the invasion with Industrial Electromatics, was it called, the company? Toby Savon's company?
International.
Yeah. I think that the small range of books has died a death over the past few years. I just don't think enough effort's been put into it. Now, I could be oversimplifying things hugely here, but I just feel that the range as it was prior to Doctor Who coming back was put down a peg or two.
Its focus
was reduced greatly.
Yes.
And I think there was more editorial control over the type of stories that could be told, and I think that has affected it considerably.
Yes, no, I don't doubt that. So again, perhaps, you know, devil's advocate, maybe it's not so much the authors that you have issue with, but maybe the constraints,
sure,
whether they be time, be they specifically editorial, that is being put upon them. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I used to quite like Justin Richards in the early days when I remember the Theatre of War. I quite enjoyed.
Yeah. And The Burning's a good one as well.
Yes, The Burning. Burning's a brilliant one, I think, if I recall rightly. Yes, yeah. I love The Burning. I remember reading that when I was stuck in London in Trafalgar Square for 9 hours. That's another story entirely. But yeah, he has done some good stuff. But I get your point. So really, I mean, the problem is at the moment is maybe in a sense people like Stephen Baxter are quite good because they are sort of such strong authors that maybe the constraints, be they time limitations or editorial, will either not apply to them or they'll be able to get around them with far more skill and professionalism than maybe, and no offense to Justin Richards, than perhaps smaller authors who perhaps don't have that control or that talent, because obviously Baxter is, the amount of awards that he's won is one of the is top of his skill of his job, his profession. Yes, his profession. He's the top of his profession.
Okay.
You know what though? I think we may have touched on this once before because we talked about big name authors writing for sci-fi shows or so on that we liked, and I had mentioned that Stephen King, who's usually a very strong author, wrote an episode of The X-Files, which had to be heavily rewritten by Chris Carter because it just didn't work for The X-Files, period. And even when you watch it, it's still not a good episode. You know, so it doesn't necessarily, a good well-known writer doesn't necessarily equate to a good story in Doctor Who just because they're writing it. They have to write a good story that works for the genre and for the show. So technically, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not this is a good thing or not until after you see the, you know, the what they've produced.
Well, let's have a look at the, I'll just go through the synopsis. Resilience, remembrance, resolution, whatever the cost. She had no name. She had only her mission. She would return home and bathe in the light of a long dead sun, even if it meant the sacrifice of this pointless little moon to do it. The Wheel of Ice. A ring of ice and steel turning around a moon of Saturn, home to a colony mining minerals for a resource-hungry future Earth, a bad place to grow up. The wheel has been plagued by problems. Maybe it's just gremlins, just bad luck. But what's the truth of the children's stories of blue dolls glimpsed upon the gigantic facility? And why won't the children go down the Warren-like mines? And then 16-year-old Fee Laws, surfing Saturn's rings, saves an enigmatic blue box from destruction. Aboard the wheel, the Doctor, Jamie and Zoe find a critical situation and three strangers who have just turned up out of nowhere look like prime candidates to be accused of sabotage. The Doctor finds himself caught up in a mystery that goes right back to the creation of the solar system, but it's a mystery that could have dire repercussions for the people on the wheel. It's a mystery that could kill them all. Sounds like standard second Doctor era fare, doesn't it?
It does very much. And of course, that is always a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because if you're doing one that's based in a very stylized era, does the author try and stay close to that era, or do they try and do new things? And your general feeling would be, if you've got a author which isn't associated with the show, who has got his own character, he's got his own, his own strengths, will he want to do that, or will he want to try and play with it? And it'll be interesting to see which he does.
Indeed. Brian?
The only thing that actually sounded like standard Second Doctor fare was that they get stuck on a space station and get accused of something. You know, I don't know how this is going to sound. It may sound awful, but the rest of it sounded more Doctor Who book to me.
Well, it is a Doctor Who book, so that's okay.
No, I know, but when I say that, what I mean is, it's like the reason I couldn't read these books for years is because I found them boring. I never found any of the books, with very few exception, to actually be proper Doctor Who stories to me. They sounded like they, I don't want to say got too in depth. I don't quite know how to put it. They just never felt right to me. I found them boring. I found them long.
Okay.
And that's kind of how this sounds. It sounds like that kind of old Doctor Who boring book story with trying to shoehorn it into an era where it doesn't quite fit. That and the fact that it's dealing with kids aboard this planet or space station or whatever. I got to be honest, and even ever since I was a kid, so this isn't me having any issue with kids, but even ever since I was a kid, I never enjoyed stories that kids were the main focus.
Yeah.
Because when I was a kid, I never related to the kids. I related to Indiana Jones. I related to Han Solo. I related to the adults that I wanted to be, that I saw myself as that kid. Yeah. You know, that's who I'm going to be, you know? And so whenever I see stories where kids are like the main focus, I just find that boring. With Harry Potter, oddly enough, being the exception, they do it pretty well.
Okay. Right. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbridge podcast with a K. Just one thing. If you haven't seen the cover of this new Doctor Who, The Wheel of Ice, from Stephen Baxter, it's a beautiful piece of work. So do have a look for it on Casterbridge. Next week's Casterbridge podcast with a K will be featuring a single subject, The Ninth Doctor. Until then, it's goodbye from all of us. Bye-bye.